The following is a presentation of GalacticNetcasts.com.
We interrupt this program to give you a bulletin just received from one of our naval units at sea. A large object traveling at supersonic speed is headed over the North Atlantic toward the east coast of the United States.
This earth of yours will be reduced to a burned out cinder.
This could be the beginning of the end for the human race. Human beings cower before the onslaught of these unearthly enemies.
It is Wednesday, November 5th, 2014, and welcome to the Alien Invasion number 123, a presentation of GalacticNetcast.com. I'm Dave Nelson. Joining me, as always, is Brad Ludwig and Anessa Moyens. What's happening, folks?
Nothing.
I built it up.
I just want to do that after that build-up.
I know. Thing. It's like, oh, why did I... Don't you want to play my game?
We're Big B powered.
Yeah, I'm running on Big V tonight.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think I ever had that kind of coffee when I was there, when I used to live.
That's a shame, because it's actually really good.
Yeah.
Just even the regular coffee is pretty nice. It's not like super bitter, and it's kind of smooth, and it's good coffee to have black.
Wait a second. Maybe I did have it. I forget. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it was only maybe a couple of blocks away from where you lived.
Yeah, yeah. But I wouldn't be surprised if I didn't drink it. I didn't go there because I'm not really a adventurer going out and try new things kind of person.
You're still in Wausau.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Hey, welcome to the show where we talk about aliens, the extraterrestrial kind, and their appearances in things like film, TV, video games, comic books, science, and in real life. And the show is sectioned off into three particular areas. We do the news, three stories each from the news, from the week's news. The Craft Corner, that's our spotlight of a certain kind of alien spacecraft, and our media picks for the week, what we watched, listened to, read, what have you. If you want to watch us live, we record it Wednesdays and or Thursday. No, I shouldn't say and or Thursdays. Just follow us on the Twitter, on the Facebook, and the Google+. We'll let you know when and where we're going to be live. And you can always go to galacticnetcast.com/live or youtube.com/galacticnetcast. So without further ado, let's get the show on the road and start it with this.
In the news.
And I do believe that Brad has the first story this week.
I am. The story I have is a question that we probably need to maybe ask ourselves. I know I've said this before in previous episodes, but perhaps we've reached a point where we've done all this searching and maybe there's nobody else out there. Maybe all this time we've been searching for life elsewhere, and without realizing that the universe is actually kind of a nasty place.
Maybe that's gonna Brad. Maybe we have to find. Maybe we have to look for our within. Maybe we have to look for our own beings from within ourselves. Sorry.
Did they legalize pot in Ontario?
Go on. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
He's like 420.
Light it up. All right. So we're going to start with this story from IO9. We have yet to discover any signs of aliens, a troubling observation that has led to much speculation. One possible solution to the great silence is that nobody's out there. It's a conclusion that sounds impossible to believe, but there may be something to it, and here's why we may be alone in the universe. Ever since physicist Enrico Fermi posed the question, "Where is everybody?" people have been wondering why we haven't seen any signs of extraterrestrial civilizations. As Fermi pointed out, the math doesn't add up. Our galaxy, at 13 billion years old, has been around long enough for aliens to explore and colonize it many times over by now. And recent work shows it should take less than a billion years, perhaps even as little as tens of millions of years. Clearly, we should have seen somebody by now. Now, the astronomer Paul Davies has said, if a planet is to be inhabited rather than merely habitable, two basic requirements must be met. And we're jumping ahead here. Okay. We've asked the question, and now we're going to look at a couple of things that would lend more credence to this. Two basic requirements must be met. The planet must first be suitable, and then life must emerge on it at some stage. Indeed, life is dependent on the presence of five critical elements or metals in the parlance of astronomers: sulfur, phosphorus, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, or SPONCE for short. makes me think of the Fonz for some reason. Don't know why.
Hey.
There's Mr. life Kata. On this planet. Hey.
No, that's the wrong show.
These heavier elements were cooked in nuclear reactions inside stars and became part of the interstellar medium only when stars reached the end of their energy-producing life. So we, as sentient beings, couldn't be possible unless a star was born, lived, and died, because all of those elements are created in the process of fission for, you know, the millions of years that a star lives.
Wow, what a sacrifice that star made for us.
Well, exactly. And at 13 billions of years, this process has gone on and on and on and on. We're the product, our solar system is the product of another dead star. But here's the thing. These heavier elements only recently became sufficiently concentrated in the interstellar medium to allow life to form. Planets around older stars, therefore, are likely to have low in SPONCE. Only around relatively young stars like ours can life emerge. So humanity would thus be among the first civilizations, perhaps the first, to arise.
Whoa, Brad!
So we might.
You just blew my mind. You blew my mind.
There you go.
Blown.
So as the kind of rinse-repeat pattern of stars living and dying happens, those materials increase in concentration and thus gives rise to life.
Hmm.
So there's one thing. Sure, it's been 13 billion years, but at least at this point in our solar system where we're at, we hit the sweet spot of having the right amount of materials to create life. And that might not be the case all over the universe. That might be, at least at this point in time in the universe, there might be only small pockets where this could perhaps exist, having that right amount of chemicals, of material to make life. But those other areas don't have the spark that makes it happen. And we've been fortunate enough to be at the right place at the right time to have that happen.
To put a sci-fi twist on this, because we, you know, we're heavy on the sci-fi, to put a sci-fi twist on this, there's been a few shows and movies where there hasn't been aliens, where there's only mm-hmm. been human, like, for instance, Battlestar Galactica. There was never an alien being besides the Cylons in that show. Trying to think of some other ones.
And they
ones.
Weren't really aliens because we had kind of created them.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. Yeah.
All right. So the next thing that we need to think about, not just having the right chemicals and materials at the right place at the right time for life to arise, we're going to talk about something else. And that is the universe has reset buttons. You know, we were talking about stars living and dying. Sometimes there are gamma ray bursts that happen from stars, from intense amounts of energy that are released. Now, that kind of radiation does not treat human or living cells that well. It will destroy them at the right concentrations. So we could be looking at, you know, maybe there are or were other living sentient beings, but they were hit by a gamma ray pulse and the plug was pulled. So again, you know, as awesome as it is living on the Earth, our place in the galaxy, in the universe, is tenuous at best. You know, we look for asteroids that could, you know, hit the planet and destroy life. We need to look for gamma ray bursts. We need to look for, you know, mass coronal ejections that could, you know, cause issues with life on Earth. You know, it's the universe isn't a safe and wonderful place filled with puppies and kittens. It's life, and life, there's a chance in everything you do. So.
Wait a second. It's been a lie to me. I thought that the universe was full of puppies and kittens.
Nope, sadly not.
Oh.
Yep.
Why? Yeah, no.
Kittens in space.
Sorry to burst your bubble there, but
no planet puppies.
Now, the last hypothesis that we're going to talk about is, and there's a number of them in the Io9 article, and we'll have a link in the show notes to for you to be able to read the entire article. But the last thing that I want to talk about is something that is called the rare earth hypothesis. And that's the suggestion that the parameters required to spawn a spacefaring species is excruciatingly narrow. With the rare earth hypothesis, that kind of links to everything else. So we've got the right place, the right time, the right chemicals, and everything happening at that moment in time to make life. Then we've got, you know, these gamma ray bursts that happen from time to time. And now you've got, if you surpass those first two, now you've got, has life evolved to a point where it is intelligent enough to make tools, to develop technology, and then actually reach space or even try to communicate? I mean, have they achieved some form of, like we use radio to contact, or SETI's been sending out messages or listening for messages all this time to see if there's life elsewhere in the universe. We've only just recently achieved this ability within the past 100 years. And with everything else that comes with technology comes ethical questions and struggles in civilizations, and we don't necessarily always have to worry about death from gamma rays, but are we going to kill ourselves in struggles, in war, or whatever? So you've only got that small window of time where you achieve enough technology, and that civilization may only exist for a short time afterwards. You just don't know. So you look at all of these variables, and the ability for an area in space having and supporting life and meeting all these requirements to achieve that is so incredibly rare. And yes, the universe is infinite, but if you have all these different variables to calculate into it, is that number that we've been looking at far too large? Have we not calculated these other things into it and realized that lightning struck, essentially, we won the lottery here, and that doesn't happen in a whole lot of places in the universe, at least for long periods of time? And maybe it's our time right now, and you know, at some point in time, the Earth will be gone. Will it be some other place in the universe that gets life? You know, maybe there's only an intelligent civilization that appears in the universe at certain points in time. Maybe there's only one that gets that shot.
Or maybe we totally screw up our planet and have to go search for another planet to live on, a.k.a. Interstellar, which opens this weekend, theaters yes. around the world.
And there's a couple of other, like I said, a couple of other items in here that should be taken into account too. And it's a very, very fascinating article. So I highly recommend you taking the chance to go to Io9, check out that article. And like I said, we'll have the link to that article in the show notes. But a great read.
Good stuff, Brad. It's both fascinating and scary at the same time.
A little bit, yes.
I feel a little bit lonely now.
You should ask Stephanie for a hug.
Or, yeah. And I want my puppies and kittens.
Always.
All right. There we go. That's story number one. Let's go to something completely different. I mean, completely different. Polar opposite from what you just talked about. Anessa, what do you got?
Basically, there is a movie whose trailer and poster has been released this week, and the movie is called Aliens vs. Titanic.
Is it exactly what it sounds like?
Kind of, okay. From what I gather in the trailer. So my first thought when I saw this was Asylum Films, just because, you know, that's kind of what they do, and they make these weird mega shark versus whatever movie, and Sharknado.
They did the Atlantic Rim. A lot of times it's like knockoffs.
Yeah, and they do a lot of the mockbusters. Yeah, there was Atlantic Rim. There was Transmorphers.
Battle Los Angeles, because there was Battle LA, or which was which? I forget. One of them was their version of the blockbuster.
Yeah, I think they just did LA.
Okay.
I'm not entirely sure, but anyway, so found this story on dreadcentral.com, and it says that once upon a time, the Asylum was king of the mockbuster. According to Vice magazine, that title now belongs to Ted Chalmers and his company, Tomcat Films. Though, judging by these trailers, I'd say he may be less Asylum-ish and more like the heir apparent to Fred Olen Ray. And Fred Olen Ray was the director, I believe, for a lot of cheesy movies. I think he starred in some of them as well.
There's got to be
like Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers.
Okay, there's got to be a documentary about this guy somewhere floating around.
Probably. But yeah, he was, you know, like, none of these I've really seen or heard of. There's Bikini Frankenstein, Twilight Vamps, Super Shark, Baby Dolls Behind Bars. Yeah, so that's the kind of movies that this Fred Olen Ray makes. And so just, if you've seen any of those, or even judging by the title, you kind of get an idea of what you're in for with Aliens versus Titanic. Aliens versus Titanic is starring former adult film star and Charlie Sheen goddess Brie Olsen and Girls and Corpses editor Robert Ryan. The movie synopsis says that offering only the finest amenities, the Titan 1C, or I guess the Titanic space cruiser, is considered the most luxurious starliner ever built. Future spring breakers on board are excited to be touring through space with some of the world's elite. A sudden meteor storm smashes into the hull, and a deadly biological alien life form is set loose on the ship. Seeking a suitable host, the retrovirus successfully merges with some of the passengers, transforming them into seemingly invisible predators with the touch of death. As the ship is destroyed, the surviving passengers crash on a remote planet, and they learn that one of them is infected.
Oh no!
They must quickly band together before it has a chance to slaughter them all. So, yeah, I highly recommend watching the trailer. It's pretty awful.
Isn't it?
I was telling Dave earlier, it looks like a few high school kids were like, "Hey, I've got a movie camera. Let's go make a movie." And they just kind of went about trying to shoot this movie. It looks really cheesy and hokey and awesome.
Isn't it interesting how so many alien movies have something to do with the aliens, like, taking over a human's body and making them do their will, kind of? Like, we talked about that last week. We had that list of alien horror films. You had the Body Snatchers movie, you had The Blob, you had The Thing. They're all about taking over people's bodies, and this sounds like the same deal, kind of.
Yeah. It sounds like, yeah, it would be taking over people's bodies, but just looking at the image on the movie poster, it looks like, there is, like, an actual alien being with, like, big sharp teeth and, yeah. So, I'm not sure when the movie comes out, honestly. It looks like it's been filming for a while.
I was really hoping this was
just wrapped up back in August or July, and now there's a trailer for it, but I don't actually see a release date. I'm sure you'll see it on DVD in stores soon.
Yeah, it's not going to be in the theaters. I can guarantee you that. I was so hoping, though, Vanessa, that this would actually be the Titanic, And that was the reason why it hit the iceberg, because really in the back, you know, going on the ship, there was like an alien invasion that nobody knew about kind of thing.
See, that would totally work even if they had just done it on the ocean. But yeah, they went for space aliens on a version of the Titanic in outer space, which, I mean, Doctor Who's done with his version of the Titanic and whatnot as well. So it wouldn't be the first place that you would see the Titanic in space.
Look, I was hoping for for the Abraham Lincoln versus the zombie movie, you know, or where it's set in history someplace with modern monsters.
Yeah, I think that would have been awesome. But I also think that maybe it would have required a bigger budget, because you'd have to somehow work with water.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're
right. And location. And so I think setting it in space, most of it's going to be enclosed, and you can just have, you know, cheesy shots of space. And then, you know, when they crash on the planet, it doesn't matter where you are, because, you know, you can make it work, I suppose.
Plus, it's way more believable.
Totally. More believable than the Titanic. Just saying.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so cool. Look for that in your red box and in your on your on demand. Probably Netflix sooner rather than later, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Probably.
I'm curious about this guy that you mentioned in the story. I want to look him up now. Fred Olin Ray. That sounds like an interesting guy to find out more about.
It does. And it seems like if you're a fan of him, then you might be a fan of the Ted Chalmers and his company, Tomcat Films, because it seems like he might have been inspired by or influenced by Fred Olin Ray.
All right. Cool. Well, thank you, Nessa. That's story number two. Moving on to story number three, Nat Geo continues exploring the UFO topic. National Geographic Channel and their subsidiary channels tend to have a lot of UFO documentary series on. I mean, there's probably not a time during the day that you can't catch some kind of, like, alien encounters or... I can't think of the other ones, but there's a new one on the horizon. It's called Invasion Earth, and it's called that somewhere in the world because turns out they have different names for the same show in different places around the world. I didn't know that. National Geographic, or Nat Geo, like most cable networks, has repeatedly featured UFO-related programming. And based on one of their upcoming shows, doesn't appear that the network plans to get rid of the UFO business or get out of the UFO business anytime soon. The show description goes like this. Have humans really seen crafts and beings from other planets? Or is there a perfectly reasonable explanation for these sightings? Invasion Earth investigates the world's most intriguing UFO sightings to answer the age-old question, are we alone, Brad? Big party pooper.
That's me.
With the help of scientists, aviation, and military experts, all the evidence is thoroughly examined and tested. This series, like I said, is airing under several different names. For example, in the UK, it's UFO Alien Invasion. In the US, it's titled UFO Conspiracies. And let's see, what else? The series explores several UFO cases familiar to UFO researchers, including the 1980 Cash Landrum UFO encounter and the 1965 Kecksburg UFO incident. I'm not familiar with the first one, but the second one, I've heard that name before, the Kecksburg UFO incident. You guys know that one?
No.
The name sounds familiar, but not really.
Okay.
Like, I can't place it with anything.
1965. What the hell was going on in 1965? Anyways, so Nick Pope, former head of the UK Ministry of Defense's UFO desk, is featured in the series. UFO Alien Invasion and Invasion Earth premiered October 31st, while UFO Conspiracies doesn't premiere in the U.S. until Wednesday, December 14th on the Science Channel. So at least people in the States have an actual premiere date when this thing's supposed to be available.
Oh, okay. So the Kecksburg UFO incident occurred December 9th, 1965, at Kecksburg, Pennsylvania, USA. A large, brilliant fireball was seen by thousands in at least six U.S. states and Ontario, Canada. It streaked over the Detroit, Michigan, Windsor, Ontario area, reportedly dropped hot metal debris over Michigan and northern Ohio, starting some grass fires, and caused sonic booms in western Pennsylvania. It was generally assumed and reported by the press to be a meteor after authorities discounted other proposed explanations such as plane crash, errant missile test, or re-entering satellite debris. So
sure sounds like a meteor to me.
Kinda.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about the metal debris, though, but in general, it just sounds like, you know, what you would normally see with a meteor, the especially one that's a fairly large size, you would see it, like, light up, and then it would get so hot they would end up, like, bursting into pieces, and so I can see debris falling, but, yeah, I don't know that it would necessarily be... It would probably be shiny, I'll give it that, just because it is made from iron and nickel.
Or a... alien spacecraft crashing and going through the atmosphere. I mean, it could give the same effect, basically, right? If it was big enough?
I suppose.
Yeah. The mothership.
Well, they're saying that the small village of Kecksburg, which is 30 miles southeast of Pittsburgh, claims something crashed in the woods. And a boy said he saw the object land. His mother saw a wisp of blue smoke arising from the woods and alerted authorities. Another reported feeling a vibration and a thump about the time the object reportedly landed. Others from Kecksburg, including local volunteer fire department members, reported finding an object in the shape of an acorn and about as large as a Volkswagen Beetle.
I was going to say, this sounds like the case of the UFO that was kind of shaped like a bell.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like the Nazi UFO.
Yes, exactly.
Story.
I just saw recently, I don't know what show it was. It was one of those documentary series about UFOs. And they highlighted or they featured the Randlesheim Air Force Base case. And that was really interesting because I didn't know that there was time travel involved. Like those guys were put under hypnosis and they said that the beings from that craft were actually time travelers. They were humans from our future.
Interesting.
Wait, yeah, I've heard that, I think. Or maybe there was a short story that I read that was very similar to that concept.
Okay. That's possible. Very possible. So anyways, hey, if you want to find out more about Kecksburg, check out this series. It premieres December 14th on the Science Channel. Before we move on to the Craft Corner, don't forget you can leave us feedback. GalacticNetcasts@gmail.com is ye old email address. GalacticNetcasts@gmail.com or... leave us a message. Call our voicemail number, 805-328-3966. 805-328-3966. We'll be glad to play that on the air. Or if you don't want us to, we don't have to. But please leave us feedback. We want to hear from you. Let's move on to this.
Please identify the craft you witnessed.
A black, triangular, three-dimensional shape. Huge, just flying, hovering in it.
Shaped like almost like between an egg and like a teardrop.
Two long cylinder objects flying over me.
This had a dome. I could see the occupants in it.
It appeared to be rotating, and it was almost circular to disc shape, and it hovered for maybe about 5 minutes.
All right, it's time for Craft Corner. Hey. It's our feature, our alien spacecraft feature in the podcast. And Anessa, it was your turn to dig up something this week. And what do you got?
Well, spoiler alert, my pick is going to be a book called Ringworld by Larry Niven. And so my pick for this craft, for the Craft Corner, is going to be the a puppeteer-built starship that was built on a No. 2 General Products hull. there are various numbers of hulls and what they are used for. And the general, the No. 2 General Products hull is designed typically to carry a single pilot. But the puppeteer ship that they're using in this story, they've modified it to accommodate 4 individuals. And so in the story, you've got two humans and then 2 aliens that are traveling. And the ship has the control cabin, a living space, life support system, and hyperdrive inside the hull. And it manages, the way it's designed, it manages to leave enough room for the four explorers. And so in the book itself, it says the General Products number 2 hull is 20 feet wide and 300 feet long, tapering to points fore and aft. Most of the ship outside the hull, on the thin, oversized wing, the life system was roomy enough to include 3 living bedrooms, a long, narrow lounge, a control cabin, and a bank of lockers, plus kitchen, auto docks, reclaimers, batteries, etc. The control panel was fitted out according to Kzinti custom, one of the aliens traveling, and was labeled in Kzinti. So it's kind of an interesting ship. As you read through the story, you kind of hear little bits and pieces more about the ship. Like, as they're traveling to the ring world, one of the humans asks for a better view of what they're seeing out in space, because she's just bored at this point. And the ship is able to basically turn transparent for the most part, except for the living quarters. And so you can't see, of course, through the living quarters, but you can see everything else around, which takes some getting used to for the people. When it travels faster than light.
Okay.
I'm like, it's faster than FTL because the Puppeteers is this alien species that's kind of weird looking, and they manage to fly to the center of the galaxy and back in a very short amount of time, and discovered that the center of the galaxy, I believe, is actually like exploding. And so within however many thousands of years, then, you know, eventually life in this area is going to die. But you still have thousands of years before this happens. But they were able to make it there and back. And I forget how much time. It was something goofy, like 46 years. Like, super quick. So they travel way faster than light. So, yeah, I already mentioned that the inside of the hole is coated with the transparent thing, so they can change it to where you can see outside beyond the walls. In an emergency, the openings could be sealed, creating an unbroken conducting surface, which allowed the creation of a stasis field, protecting everything inside the hull, which is good for landing and whatnot. It had 4 fusion drive motors, with one pair pointing ahead and the other astern. The smaller forward-facing pair were designed for braking, and all could be used as weapons. The ship could accelerate at nearly 200 Gs, which I guess is the faster than light. and the roomy life system included 3 cabins, a lounge, and I already went through all of that because I just read that through the book. But
you know what? Yeah. That transparency thing reminds me of that picture I keep on seeing, that story I keep on seeing about the airplane, this future airliner that you'll be able to actually see through the walls, which freaks me out.
Yeah, I've seen that story.
I wouldn't want that.
It's popped up. That would be really weird. I'm content with just a little window. Yeah. If they made it a little bigger, I would be cool with that, but I'm not quite sure how I would feel if I could see the ground getting farther away from my feet.
I would get some kind of weird, like, I'd feel really small or something like that. It would freak me out.
I don't know that I could handle that. And then other things that were on the ship, you've got the life system, 3 cabins, lounge, control cabin with controls. You've got various exploration equipment, including fly cycles, which were basically, from what I understood, to be like small kind of pods that people could fly around in, because they do once the ship gets damaged. They've got flying backpacks, which I don't really remember much of, honestly. Food testers to see if food is safe for them to consume on the ring world. And they've got all sorts of other stuff: first aid kits, air sensors, filters, flashlight lasers, and dueling sonic stunners.
Wow, so they seem like they're well equipped there. They got a lot of stuff.
They have a lot of stuff, and it's funny. Because in the book, as they're starting out on this journey, and they're looking to see, like, all the passengers that are joining this puppeteer, they're noticing the equipment and stuff on the ship, and they notice that everything that's there could potentially be used as a weapon. I mean, flashlight, laser, you don't really need a laser on a flashlight, just saying. And so they kind of feel like there's something they're not being told, and they end up renaming this number two general products hull the Lying Bastard. And they end up calling it the Liar for short because they feel like they're being lied to about the purpose of going to the Ring World. Like, they're not being told the entire truth. So, but anyway.
We have a question or a clarification from Gregor in the audience tonight.
Okay.
The planes that we're talking about, they don't have see-through walls. They're basically big TV screens, which I knew. I just didn't want to get into that much detail. But thanks, Gregor. Appreciate
it. It would still be really weird, though. A little, I don't know, off-putting.
Yeah, if you're afraid of heights, no way. No way that's going to happen.
Probably wouldn't book a flight on that particular plane.
No.
So, now, yeah, I would just, I don't know, I'd just keep flying Delta. With their little windows and their little bags of pretzels.
Or you know what? Even better, don't have it so everybody can see it. Have it so it's kind of like a Oculus Rift deal where you have to wear something to see this.
Oh, that would be kind of cool. I haven't tried Oculus Rift, but I have tried another virtual reality thing. And I've heard that Oculus Rift is better than what I had tried, but if you're prone to motion sickness, it's not the way to go.
No, I don't imagine.
Because I remember when I worked at down in Texas, one of the friends of my boss came up and he was trying this new software program and this virtual reality thing, and we all tried it out. And after about 5 or 10 minutes, I'm like, okay, I'm done. Here you go. I'm going to go puke now. Because I could feel myself getting really flush.
Ew.
And it was cool because, you know, you could look down and around and you're seeing, you know, like sharks and you see the sky above and you're trying not to get eaten and whatnot. But yeah, after about 5 or 10 minutes, I'm like, okay, I'm done. So long as they have a little warning, I don't think Oculus Rift is quite as bad from what I hear. I hear it's actually pretty good. So maybe people wouldn't get motion sickness from it.
Well, time will tell, I guess.
Yeah. Maybe they can include a little Dramamine pill and be like, here, take this.
For your convenience. So it sounds like that book really describes that ship very well.
Yeah, it does over time, because you'll have the main character as Louis Wu. It could be Louis Wu, but I like Louis Wu because it kind of
Louis Wu!
Louis Wu! Like, it's probably Louis, but I call him Louis Wu. But yeah, he seems to be kind of observant with, like, hey, what's this for? And this doesn't seem right, sort of thing. And he's lived a long life, couple hundred years. So he's seen a lot of crap. So.
Excellent. But, yeah. All right. Well, I can't wait to hear more about Ringworld in the picks coming up.
Well, that's the first pick, so.
All right. Okay. Well, let's do.
I figured I would just keep on talking about
it. Yeah. Okay. So the Craft Corner feature is officially done. Now we're into the picks. Anessa, what do you got this week?
Surprise! I've got Ringworld.
Whoa.
By Larry Niven.
What?
I know.
Didn't see that coming.
I'm totally not expecting that. It was written and published in 1970. So it is an older book, old sci-fi book.
It's ancient.
I read it in high school, but I don't remember hardly a single thing about it.
It's not ancient. It's just older.
Back in my day.
So the synopsis from Goodreads says, Pearson's puppeteers, three-legged, two-head aliens find immense structure in unexplored part of the universe. Frightened of meeting the builders, they send a team of two humans, a puppeteer, and a kazin. And the kazin is an 8-foot red fur cat-like alien.
And he plays a kazoo.
And sadly, no. He does, however, eat meat. Surprise. Big cat eats meat. Mm-hmm. Ringworld is 180 million miles across Sun Et Center. But the expedition crashes and the crew face a disastrously long trek. So I'm not going to lie, the first chunk of the book was kind of slow. Because you have this puppeteer named Nessus, and he's trying to recruit people to go with him to this ring world to explore it, because they want to learn more about how it was made, why it was made, and then maybe use some of that same methodology into making a ring world of their own for their species to live on. But the puppeteers are a very... They come across as being very cowardice, because they'll turn around and run away in the face of danger, or they'll just completely curl up into a ball if there's any sort of danger detected. So they will literally tuck themselves into a ball, and they won't come out until it's over. So they need other people that are not going to curl up into a ball to help them out with the exploration and the journey. And so the first chunk of the book is the Nessus trying to recruit a couple of other people. And so he recruits one person, one human, that is 200 years old, and that's Louis Wu, and a 20-year-old girl. And she's recruited for the sheer fact that she's a good luck charm. She has come from generations of lucky people. She's never been hurt. She's never, you know, lost anything. She's always been lucky. And so she's chosen as a good luck charm, essentially. And then you have this other alien called the Kazin, and he's there because he's good at the whole, he's there to fly the ship. He's also not afraid of stuff, and I think he's there just in case things get rough. He's not ready, or he's not afraid to step up and fight. and so that first chunk of the book is kind of slow, because there's an entire chapter dedicated to the human that's the good luck charm, and I'm like, for the love of God, just say you will go, because I know you're going to go. They've already dedicated an entire chapter to you. And the entire chapter's like, well, I don't really want to go. Yeah, you guys can find somebody else. I'm not going to go. And then at the end, she's like, okay, I'll go. She ends up being a really annoying character. She doesn't. I think that's kind of my complaint, is the one female character that's with the story the longest, she doesn't really do much for the crew aside from her luck doesn't allow them to die, I guess, because she's there. Things could be worse. But yeah, beyond that, she seems pretty useless. But it gets actually really cool once you get to the ring world, because the way it's described, you get a sense that it's incredibly huge, even just being wide, like, because, you know, it's flat. Just think of like a ribbon going around in a circle. The width of that ribbon, I forget how far it is, but it's hundreds of thousands of miles wide. And the actual ring world is 180 miles across, and the civilization that was on there has kind of collapsed a bit. And it seems like they don't really know what's going on with the other parts of the ring world, and they have kind of become a little more primitive. Like, they're not advanced anymore. Like, as technology broke, they never knew how to fix it anymore. And so they've got a lot of these flying buildings and stuff that's just flying, and they don't know how to get up there, and they just assume that that's heaven, and that's where the engineers live that built this world.
So can you explain kind of the geometry and the how the ring world is built, and how it, you know, is it around a star, or what? How does it work? I don't understand.
Okay, like if you imagine a ribbon, and you take this wide, flat ribbon and make a circle with it, and then put a sun in the middle of it, it's kind of what it sounds like. They mentioned the Dyson sphere, but I didn't really get the Dyson sphere vibe from it. But if you know what the Dyson sphere is, it's like this ball that collapses in on itself, and it ends up being spiky. And when you expand it, it's got different arms and stuff that connect. It's multi-jointed. And it's hollow on the inside, and it's just like this skeletal frame of a ball. And so if you try to imagine something like that, that's kind of what I imagine as a Dyson sphere, but at the same time, it kind of sounds like it's just this big circular ring that has been built around a sun, and it's got jets on one side that keep it in its orbit. Otherwise, it would just kind of float away.
Okay.
And the way it's positioned, because it's around a sun, it's always going to have light shining on it. And so they have these tiles that orbit on the inside that basically provide nighttime. They provide darkness. So there is daylight and darkness on the planet. Otherwise, it would be constant sun. So, but yeah, just imagine circle, sun in the middle.
Okay, got it. All right.
I'm like a circle and then a sun in the middle. But it's, like, insanely huge.
Communication's got to be problematic. If you want to, you know, talk to somebody on the complete other end of this ring, there's got to be a major lag in communications.
You would think, but at the same time, at the point where they arrive on Ringworld, like, pretty much all the technology has collapsed. It's no longer in use, and so people are very isolated from each other. And they notice this as they come across different tribes that, you know, the language is slightly different because it's evolved differently in their area. But they do notice that there are places at the edge of the ring world where people could go to travel, like a kind of like a commute, a way to commute long distances along the edges of the rings. But yeah, it's actually a pretty interesting story to read. Just the first part was kind of slow. But there's a whole series of Ringworld. And the second book was essentially, from what I understand, is it was written to explain how some of the stuff in the first book works. 'Cause there have been papers that have been written about Ringworld, like the physics of Ringworld, like legit papers written about it. And it's funny, I don't know if it's in this book, but yeah, it's not. But the original book, the way that the story starts out is you start out with Louis Wu, and he's celebrating his 200th birthday. And he's basically, they have these little port things that you can jump into and then pop out at another location, because society or Earth at that point, the population has expanded so much that all the countries just blend together. There are no deserted areas. Everything is habited.
It's like a giant city. It's a city world, a world city.
Yeah, it's one big city world. And so he's jumping through these tubes or whatever you call them, like teleport thing.
Oh, like bank tubes?
Time zones.
Bank tubes?
So he's like teleporting from one time zone to another to make his 200th birthday longer, because he doesn't feel like 24 hours is enough for 200 years to celebrate. But in the original book that was released, they had him traveling eastward. And you lose time as you travel eastward.
Ah.
And he got a lot of flack for that. And so the second publication of this book, he put in the note, like, hey, if you happen to own the first copy that was released, it's got this mistake in it, keep it, it's worth money now. And in every publication afterwards, he corrected it, so Louis Wu is traveling westwards and gaining time.
Nice.
So
that's a neat
He at least had a sense of humor about that. And then there are, I think, like 6 prequel books written about Ringworld, and it's written about different, I think, not just the Ringworld itself, but about the puppeteers. So this alien race that you're dealing with, and then one of the characters from the Ringworld that they encounter, and the Ringworld itself, and then another book about the engineers and whatnot. So, and apparently it was the inspiration for Halo set up.
Oh, yes. Neat. So, I had no idea. That's cool.
Yeah, but I recommend giving it a read. Like I said, for me, the first chunk was kind of meh, but it does pick up once they get to the ring world. Like, stuff starts to happen, and they start encountering people and just different sites and plants, which sunflowers on the ring world, not so friendly.
All right, good to know. Note, I take a note of that if you're traveling to Ringworld.
Yes, if you plan to go to the Ringworld, watch out for the sunflowers.
All right, cool. All right, Anessa, thank you very much. Let's move on to Brad. What is your pick this week?
Oh, my pick. Yeah, exactly. So I've been on a little bit of a kick with classic television, classic movies, and classic sci-fi. And one show that I've heard of but have never seen was My Favorite Martian. And this was a show that ran for 3 years, and it starred Bill Bixby, a young Bill Bixby. Bill Bixby kind of later was known for his turn as Dr. Banner in the Incredible Hulk television series.
Not Bruce, but David Banner.
In the show, it was David Bruce Banner, but in the comics, his name is Bruce David Banner.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, they switched the names around. So, and the episode I watched was the first episode. I mean, if you're going to start with a series you've only heard little bits about and have seen, you know, still photos of, you might as well begin at the beginning. And the show has a charm to it that you're just, you know, Bill Bixby's wearing pajamas, and when he gets up, he's putting on his slippers and he's putting on his robe, you know, just that whole classic golden age of television sensibility of things, as it should. And our main character, Bill Bixby, is a reporter for the San Francisco Globe. And he has been tasked with reporting on a new supersonic jet that the Air Force base has been working on. And it pushes beyond Mach 5, so kind of a big deal. Now, while this is happening, there is a blip on the radar, and this blip is moving twice the speed as this supersonic jet. And the pilot reports in that, you know, there's a flying saucer, and the commanding officer who is overseeing this test, you know, gets on and says, "Hey, I'll have none of that talk, and you obviously need to come in and get a rest, and you know whatnot." So this is at the point in time, you know, post World War II, UFOs have definitely come to the fore, and it's a situation. It's a sitcom, and it's a sitcom that finds us with Tim the reporter meeting with a crashed Martian, and the Martian is played by Walston.
Yeah, and that guy.
I forgot his last name now.
He's Big B from speaking of Big B, he's he's Big B from the Star Trek series. He was the groundskeeper at Starfleet Academy.
Yes, Ray Walston. There we go. Whew. Oh boy. And it turns out that when you first have the introduction of Bill Bixby's character, Tim O'Hara, meeting with the Martian, you see that he's crashed, and Tim pulls the Martian out of the vehicle and lays him on the ground, and he's not sure what to do. And Ray Walston, the Martian, speaks perfect English. He doesn't have makeup on him. He doesn't look weird in any way. He looks human, and he states that he is an anthropologist who specializes in Earth, and he was there to, you know, investigate things, find out more about the Earth and the primitive culture, and see how things are doing and report back. And that now that his ship has crashed, he's kind of stuck on Earth until he can fix the. I'm not going to tell all the details about the show, but essentially, by the time we're done with the first episode, the Martian is now Tim O'Hara's Uncle Martin, who is in town and staying with his nephew. And the garage that and Tim rents an apartment above the garage, and the home is owned by a woman. And in the first episode, we don't know if she has a husband, but there's definitely her and her daughter and a visiting, very attractive female relative who Tim and what is her name? Anna, Angela Brown. Oh, she's only in three episodes. Okay, so it must have essentially just went back to the Mrs. Brown and the relationship of Tim and Uncle Martin living the weird sitcom life of an alien with a crashed UFO in the garage that could be found at any point in time.
Hijinks? A lot of hijinks?
Lots of hijinks and shenanigans.
Okay.
We know that Uncle Martin can turn himself invisible for short periods of time, and he is also telepathic as his Martian powers, and this operates on the premise that humans only use a small percentage of their brain, but Martians use all of their brain, which is why they have these exceptional abilities, which now, we know is false.
Now, is the entirety
of our brain.
Now, is he actually from, do they say Mars? Do they say that?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes. He is from Mars. He is an anthropologist visiting Mars to investigate Earth and Earth culture, as primitive as it is.
All right. Cool. My favorite Martian. Good stuff. Is that all you got there, my friend?
Yeah, I don't want to give away much more. They do, and just for folks and I did check this out on Hulu. For those of you that do check it out on Hulu, they do have an unaired pilot version, but that's just an unedited version where they have extra stuff that they just cut out for the finished pilot. So
okay.
You can skip that.
All right. Cool. Thank you very much, Mr. Ludwig. All right. Wrapping up the picks this week. Going to make mine real short because it was a short film, 15 minutes long. It's called The Abandon. It is from 2013 from award-winning playwright and screenwriter Keith Joseph Adkins. A series, like I said, called Abandon. And it was used as a sales pitch to help raise funds to complete an entire series or season of a TV series. And this guy is an African-American, and what he wanted to do is he wanted to set an alien invasion series, like a survival series, with a group of African-American characters, which he thought was lacking in our entertainment industry, which he's right. You don't see that kind of thing. So that's what his goal was in making this series. He wanted to make kind of a cross between Alien, the original Ridley Scott Alien film, and The Descent, which was a pretty recent film, where a group of women, I believe, they base jump into this big hole and they find some weird stuff. That's all I know about it, because I've seen the previews for it, and that's it. Have you guys seen The Descent?
No.
Okay, well, for those listening or watching the show, please fill us in on The Descent, because none of us know about it. But it's supposed to be a cross between The Descent and Alien. It's called The Abandon, and it's short. It's these guys, they're on this kind of, like, they do a retreat every year where they get together, they go out to the woods, and they don't have cell phones, they don't bring alcohol, they kind of cut off ties for a week from the rest of the world. And that's what they're about to do when aliens attack. And they get to their location where they park their cars and they kind of walk in. And that's where all this stuff kind of goes down. You never see the aliens. You only hear this weird, spooky sound. They find their one buddy in the woods already dead. Another buddy they lose. And then two or three of them end up at this abandoned house. I guess that's where the name comes, The Abandon. And that's where the aliens kind of make their presence known, but you never see them. You see this weird like light or this these what looks like little crystals kind of floating in the air, and that's supposed to represent what the characters are looking at outside when the aliens arrive. So I highly recommend it, and we'll put a link in the show notes to check out The Abandon, this 15 minute long pitch for a new TV series that they were trying to crowdfund back in 2013. So, we have The Abandon, we have My Favorite Martian, and we have Ringworld. Quite the variety of picks this week. A variety of stuff on the show. We've really covered a lot of ground on this edition of the Alien Invasion.
Absolutely, we have.
And we thank you for listening. And if you'd like to give us feedback on the stuff that we've talked about on this episode, 805-328-3966 or email galacticnetcasts@gmail.com. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio. Just search for Galactic Netcast or search for the Alien Invasion. We've also got a link on our website to it at galacticnetcasts.com, the link where you can subscribe or just listen to the show. And that's going to do it for episode 123 of the Alien Invasion from galacticnetcast.com. Final thoughts, Brad, you're first.
You know, I think I'm going to endeavor to check out more 50s sci-fi. That's my goal.
Don't you kind of feel like it's nostalgic? It's kind of like it was a more innocent time back then. We didn't know as much, you know? Sure, it was hokey, but still at the same time, we had so much hope.
Yes, absolutely.
And we thought people actually lived on Mars.
Yes.
They totally live on Mars. They're just underground.
Hey, Vanessa, your microphone, you're on the wrong mic. You're on your headset mic's not on.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep, it missed a switch.
To change at this point, I think.
Okay, all right. Well, yell your final thought. What's your final thought, Vanessa?
Oh, maybe it was because this was up and out of the way. Is that better?
Yes, it is.
Okay, because I'm like, well, if it's not working at this point, I'm just going to wait and figure it out later. Man, that totally threw me off, my final thought.
Was it about eating or drinking or you're tired or you want to do something? Am I in the right ballpark?
It wasn't food related because I'm not hungry. I had tacos earlier.
Okay.
I had coffee. I already know about the coffee.
Okay. Well, this may be your
first... Well, on the upside, I've knocked out one book on my pile of books.
All right. Keep on going. Oh. Keep chugging along there, Vanessa.
Must do all the reading.
All right. Again, thanks everybody for joining us on this edition of The Alien Invasion. Till next time, we'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to a presentation of GalacticNetcasts.com. For more about the show you just listened to, including how to subscribe, give us feedback, links to our social feeds, and more, please visit www.galacticnetcasts.com.